Please excuse us. We're having technical difficulties that are beyond our control. But it's only a temporary situation, meaning that we're ready to rock and roll. Right now.
When you say Booker, I think everyone's heart gets a little excited about it. And they say, yes, indeed.
Booker was probably one of the most fired people in my band in 5 years or so that he played in it.
I did it, and I am the best that ever did it. And I'd have said the same thing if I wasn't smoking or drinking, too.
But I'd always hire him back. And that was the show of the spirit of what he could do. He could do just about anything.
He was very much a stream of consciousness player with a huge repertoire of songs, harmonic ideas, and rhythmic ideas that he pulled out of the hat like a musical magician.
We're going to introduce James Carroll Booker, also known as the Piano Prince, sometimes called the Ivory Emperor.
Hello, I'm Joe Boyd, writer and record producer. The first time I met James Carroll Booker III was in a recording session in Los Angeles, 1973. Just sat down and played perfectly, just beautifully in the New Orleans style with incredible fluency. My next encounter with James was in New York City a few years later when I was recording a classic New Orleans R&B song by Huey Piano Smith called High Blood Pressure with a singer called Jeff Muldaur. I knew that James would be absolutely perfect for it. Engineer John Wood.
Booker arrived at the studio and he's dressed in a pink cerise jumpsuit, a patch over one eye. He sits down at the piano and he just starts vamping away. Every time we stop a take, he's playing something else and starting to annoy everybody else in the room a little bit. And he carried this little, it was like a plastic handbag, which was, and it was also pink, and it was a little cassette recorder in it. And he would record everything on his little recorder. So when we were playing back in the control room, he would infuriate everybody else on the session by staying out in the studio and playing his own recording.
The rest of the musicians were an all-star team of New York session guys. Very cool, very professional. James was bouncing off the walls, talking a mile a minute. I could see these New York session guys just rolling their eyes, thinking, who is this freak? So I tried to distract him during a break. I asked if he knew a Louisiana Dopers song that I'd heard once, called Junko Partner. And Booker looked at me, stopped playing, gave me this funny look, and he said, Junko Partner? Know it? That's my theme song.
Down the road, whoa, come a Junko Partner right now.
And it was just amazing. And after consulting with John Wood, my engineer, I offered James $1,000 if he would let us record him in New Orleans, just him and piano. And he rejected the idea out of hand. He said he needed his band. But sure enough, 3 weeks later, my phone rang. It was James saying, how about that $1,000?
Down the road, come on, Junko Partner.
And he only had one demand.
He was loaded, he was loaded.
He insisted that he have on the piano a candelabra. I asked him why. He said, Because I'm the Black Liberace, baby.
Is everyone all right?
New Orleans pianist and composer Alan Toussaint knew Booker in the 50s when they were both starting out.
Well, he was so classically trained, he could play Rachmaninoff as a little boy. He must have practiced when he was 6 months old, I don't know, because by the time I heard him, he was 12, and it sounds like someone who has been playing for 20 years.
Can you tell a little bit about how you and Booker started playing at such a young age in clubs and on records and things in New Orleans?
During those days, radio stations usually had a little piano in their station. And Booker came up just like I did on an old upright that was never totally in tune, but radio stations' pianos was a little better than ours. So we'd go in when no one was on as a special artisan, sit in and play those pianos. And sometime the DJs would say, well, go in and play a piece on the air.
Booker could play. He could imitate other piano players and sound better than they could.
Booker's manager, John Parsons.
You could name many New Orleans piano players in the traditions. Professor Longhair, Fats Domino. They would use James Booker, actually, if you look at some of Fats Domino's old records. You look at the fine print, it's James Booker on the piano.
Well, I'm going to New Orleans, I'm going to see the Mardi Gras.
Because Booker could play like all of these people. He could play long hair stuff. Little Richard is another one, Ray Charles. And he could sound better than they did.
I want to know what's kind of a fall.
But they could not play like James Booker.
Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm playing for you tonight is the story of all of my influences, from Beethoven to Ray Charles. Hope you like it.
Listening to James play and sing, I saw him as a kind of present-day Jelly Roll Morton, that great pioneer of New Orleans jazz piano. He revered Jelly Roll, even joking on occasion that he was his reincarnation.
All right, you know, it is true that I was born on December 17th, 1939, at Charity Hospital. Unfortunately, I wasn't quick to point out that Jelly Roll did die around the same year. Jelly Roll also went around Biloxi, Mississippi, where I was raised by my mother's sister in nearby Bay St. Louis, Mississippi.
In the 1950s, the New Orleans rhythm and blues scene was incredibly vibrant.
You set my soul on fire.
Booker, at the extraordinarily young age of 12, started recording. In 1960, he had his biggest hit, an instrumental called Gonzo. Mack Rabenik, better known as Dr. John, is another influential New Orleans pianist who worked with and learned from Booker.
Booker taught me how to play organ. He was a slamming teacher. After he'd play his piano lessons, which was a lot of Bach stuff and things like that, he would play all of these hip boogie-woogies from that time zone. Back then, when he was just a kid, we didn't touch the piano. You know, that's how Booker had us intimidated back then.
Well, there were all kinds of little intricate things going on, and they were consistently on and final. And he played it as if he was living the moment.
Do you think you can explain a little bit about what it is about Booker's technique that makes him unique, that is so remarkable? I mean, is there something that differentiates him in the way he uses his left hand or the way he...
His left hand is very, very interesting, because there's a general copycat kind of Booker thing that we all have tried to do, we all mimic at sometimes. And it sounds like a regular romping junk, semi-junker blues. But when you really scrutinize it, there's some rolls going in between the surface of what you hear, which is only Booker. And it would be so consistent and so on till you would never know how complicated that is. It just sounds like, oh, he's just having a good time like everyone else. It seemed to be better, but we don't know why.
Josh Paxton has spent years transcribing many of Booker's recordings.
He would do with one hand what most piano players would need both hands to do. So you have a bass line, which sounds like this. Then an accompaniment with some chords over the top of it, which sounds like this. Which sounds like two hands, and it was when I was playing it just then. But now let me go back and do what Booker did, which is play that whole thing with just the left hand. Now that was the same thing, but it was all with one hand. And what doing that allows me to do is to do this with this over top of it. The upshot of the style that he was able to create with playing all these different parts at the same time is that he was able to make the piano sound like a whole band. You hear the bass, you hear the guitar. If he's stomping his feet, you hear the drums along with it. So by creating that full sound, instead of just sounding like one musician, he sounds like four or five all at once.
Throughout the 60s and 70s, Booker was in great demand as a session musician. He was in Mack Rabennick's band for several years and appeared on dozens of R&B records, playing with many greats, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Little Richard. But at that point, he was always just a sideman, never stepping into the spotlight to show the full range of what he could do. Alan Toussaint.
That's a very good question. Why Booker didn't rise to fame and popularity that it seemed like he would have been well worthy of. All musicians always thought of him as, yes, he is the cat, he is the guy. And how New Orleans in general, well, he always could get a gig. It may have not been the gigs that were suitable for Freeman, but I think Booker, for some people, for many, was a problem to understand and get along with and to guarantee that he would cooperate. Like he may be on a gig somewhere and after the intermission, Booker may not show up on the way back. But I don't really think that he is a bad guy that happened. It was just that he was a kind of radical individual in some ways.
Oh, just let them talk. If they want to.
Mack Rabennick.
The Mississippi police pulled us over at one time, and They said, "Oh, it smells like weed in here." And Booker says, "Yes, officer, I saw you coming with your lights, and I threw it all down the road." And the police, instead of pulling us over more, said, "Get the hell out of here." And only Booker could have pulled that one off.
"He let them whisper, let them whisper, for they know now, they know, they know now."
I mean, it says that me and Booker were originally junkies.
"What's between you and I?"
He changed from being just a junkie to an acid head and a lot of other drug things.
"You know I'll be loving you."
I had fired him for the last time out of my band, and I told him, "Please don't go to New Orleans. They have an APB out for you, and they're going to pick you up." But knowing Booker, we should have knew he was going to come back. But Booker went to New Orleans and got picked up.
After a spell in prison for drug offenses, Booker tried to get his life back on track. Drummer Jim Sherrick played with him in a band in the early 70s.
I was playing with James at a time where he was very actively trying to improve his life. He had put distance between himself and a lot of other great musicians. I never, ever played a gig with James where James didn't show up, where he stopped playing, or any of the things that you heard so much about.
It was around that time that we came to New Orleans to record Jungle Partner with James. It went just as I imagined.
All right.
He'd been skeptical, but once he sat down, looked at that candelabra, he just came out with tune after tune after tune. Incredible. In a huge variety of styles. I think that was the moment when he realized just how well he could hold his own as a solo performer. Some of the best live recordings of Booker are from the trips he made to Europe soon after that.
James Booker, welcome to England.
Very good to be back.
And this occasion is for a European tour.
Yes. I'm doing an album in East Berlin, and I'm doing a tour of Germany.
The styles that you've been playing for us today represent the best part of the New Orleans piano, right? The Fats Domino style, the Alan Toussaint style.
Yeah, well, that was a very small portion, you know. It would take me the rest of the year to really go through the whole thing.
All right. Is everybody all right out there?
Did he talk a lot about Europe and what it was like playing over there and how he was received?
Everybody okay?
Yes, he did. He had such a great reception there.
I thought so.
And they were very into his performance. They appreciated the amount of talent he had on the piano, and he was playing some large halls in Germany particularly. He was tremendously inspired by all of that. I remember when he returned to the States for the first time, it was a renewal time for him. I think he felt like he was starting to feel some real acceptance, and unfortunately, the backside to that is he came back to New Orleans, and we're somewhat notorious for doing this. People can be superstars in Europe and come back to New Orleans and be faced with the same situation of playing to small crowds again. He found that to be particularly frustrating.
What would you like there? I think I'll do what I feel like doing. That's what I better do. Do what I feel like doing.
I was profoundly affected by being with somebody that was that amazing and was still struggling.
Thank you, baby. God bless you.
Man, if you're this great and you're still struggling and you're still making $35, $40 for playing three sets a night or something like this, then there had to be something wrong.
I deserve the Congressional Medal of Honor for working 25 years without a vacation. That's because I love it. If money was everything, I wouldn't be here now because I'd have quit it a long time ago.
The Maple Leaf was a popular New Orleans club which became a home for James, with the uniquely eccentric combination of music venue and laundromat. You could clean your clothes and hear Booker play at the same time. The manager, when Booker started his residency there, was John Parsons.
James used to love to hang out at the Maple Leaf in the day. So he would come in, and Alice would be working, the barmaid, who invented a drink for him called a pink panty. And Booker would do his laundry there. And the way he would do that, he would come in and he would take off all his clothes down to his underwear. And he would put his clothes in the washer, and a woman would come in and you'd hear a scream. And there's a naked man in the laundromat. And it would be Booker.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. The more the merrier, my dear, the more the merrier.
James's mind really was kind of getting out of control, and he was wearing his underwear on stage and urinating in cups, all the stuff that people love to talk about, that when your friend does this, it hurts you deep to your soul.
Has this time healed your wound, my dear?
One thing I think that I avoid talking about a lot of times is James's homosexuality, which I think is really inconsequential to his music. But I can remember one time going to Lou and Charlie's, which was a jazz club in New Orleans. And it was a rainy night, stopped the car right before Lou and Charlie's, and James went into this thing about that he was nothing, that he had been unsuccessful in love and his sexual acquaintances in life, and that he was nothing. He was neuter, he said.
Booker, he had a very hard head about a lot of things, and you couldn't break through his anythings. We had lost a lot of musicians because of Booker over the years, but he was so good. I mean, there was just no way we would consider leaving him fired. I mean, he was special.
Whatever piece of music that James decided to play, and he had a huge variety, he channeled his own inner pain into these songs. He was able to make you feel as if he was speaking of himself even when he was doing a standard.
Nobody cares about me. I ain't even got a friend. Don't even know I'm living. When will my troubles end? You know that black night is falling.
Despite his poor health, James recorded another studio album in the early 80s with record producer Scott Billington.
When I knew him, I think he was struggling more than ever to get his life together because he'd had addiction problems and maybe some mental illness. And he'd taken to wearing a three-piece suit and tie, and he'd gotten a job at New Orleans City Hall as a typist and file clerk. It was a real challenge to get him to engage with the other musicians, to engage with himself. He led the other musicians on a sort of cat-and-mouse chase for the first couple days. So on the third day, I decided I'd go to the studio early and just listen to all of the tape that we'd captured. And there, standing at the door of the studio when I arrived, was James Booker. And he asked me, he said, "Scott, can I go in and record now?" And I said, "Sure, man, let's go."
In 1983, James's demons finally caught up with him.
I got a call from Charity Hospital from a nurse, and they wanted to know, "Is this Jim Sherrick?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And she said, "I'm calling from Charity Hospital. Do you know James Carroll Booker?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And I immediately said, "Is James dead?" And she said, "Sir, I'm so sorry. I really can't tell you that." And I continued. I said, "Ma'am, please tell me, is James okay? Is there something wrong?" And she finally relented and said, "Yes, sir. I'm sorry to tell you that Mr. Booker has expired."
He was wheeled into Charity Hospital in a wheelchair, where whoever brought him there left him, and he died while he was waiting to be seen at the hospital probably as a result of a drug overdose.
Today, I see James as part of a long tradition of great piano players. Classical, romantic, blues, jazz, everything in between. From showmen like Liszt, their coattails hanging over the back of the piano stool, right up to his own idols like Professor Longhair and even Liberace.
Hope you come back tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen. 'Cause that's it for tonight. I say good night, sweetheart. Good night.
James Carroll Booker III took all of it in. But he always made it completely New Orleans and completely his own. The Black Liberace was presented by me, Joe Boyd. It was produced by Joe Wheeler and was a Brooke Lapping production for BBC World Service.